go. All right, good evening. Hi, everyone. This is Deborah from the Deborah Margolis from the MSU Libraries. I'm the liaison to our Jewish Studies program, and I'm so happy to see you all here. You know, friends from the Jewish community and from the Greek community, and tonight, if we didn't already know, we'll learn that those two aren't mutually exclusive, right? The Greek and Jewish communities. We're so excited to have Marcia here, and I wanted to thank Marcia and her museum for donating about 20 new books and DVDs on Greek and Sephardic Jewry to our library, and you'll see many of them on display as you came in. Those are available for you to borrow, so please borrow them, read them, and learn, okay? So thank you again for that donation, very nice. And two of the books, Marcia has, she was either the translator or the editor, so you can look for those. And I'm going to introduce Ken Walzer. He's a professor of history in James Madison College, and he's the director of our Jewish Studies program, and a great friend of the library here. So, happy to have him.
First, thank you all for coming tonight. I think you're in for a special treat. Some of us have been spending part of yesterday and all of today with Marcia, and she's a walking encyclopedia. It's really terrific. I'm particularly pleased tonight, in an effort to honor the memory of our colleague Ada Finifter, who died a year ago, and to acknowledge the bequest that she left to MSU Jewish Studies, to introduce you to our guest, who is Ada's friend, Marcia Economopoulos. Marcia Haddad Economopoulos. We've been trying to get that straight over the last week. We talk on the phone. She is the museum director of Kehila Kadosha Yanina, the Holy Congregation of Yanina, which is the Ramoniote Jewish synagogue on New York's Lower East Side, on Broome Street. For those of you who know the geography of the Lower East Side, that's one block south of Delancey Street, running east and west. Delancey Street runs into the Williamsburg Bridge and goes across to Brooklyn. The next major thoroughfare is Canal Street, which is the tip of Chinatown. That runs into the Manhattan Bridge, goes across to Brooklyn. And the area in between Canal on the south and Delancey on the north was part of the historic New York Lower East Side, immigrant Jewish America. The synagogue that she is the museum director in connection with is currently celebrating its 85th anniversary as a synagogue. The building was built in 1927. And this is, I think, Marcia's 15th year with the museum?
The museum's 15th year, my 8th year.
Okay, 8th year with the museum. And no one is better prepared to speak on the subject that she's speaking on tonight, Ramonio Jewry on New York's Lower East Side. Now, Ada was the granddaughter on her maternal side of a man by the name of Leon Colchimuro, a Ramonio Jew. Leon came as an immigrant in the mass immigration through Ellis Island in 1905, but he came not as a part of the larger Ashkenazi migration from Poland and from Galicia, nor even as part of the smaller Sephardic migration, although the Ramonio Jews were thought to be part of the Sephardic, but as a connected with a special migration of a smaller group called Ramonio Jews. And I'll leave it to Marcia to explain to you who Ramonio Jews are, where they come from, and why is it, and this is the big question for us, why is it that they're still so self-conscious about being a solidary group after mixing with millions and millions of others in the larger history of Jewish America? Ada was very involved with the reclamation and restoration of Kehillah Kedosha Yanina. And it's not surprising that she was involved with that, and that's how she came to know Marcia. Her cousin Leonard Colchamoro was the architect who did the restoration inside the building. It's on the historic landmarks. The outside was done by other people, but Leonard did the inside. And there are three Colchamoros who sit on the board of Kehillah Kedosha Yanina. Ada thought, as part of the bequest that she left to Jewish Studies, there was a lot for other people to learn in studying and knowing about the Ramonio Jewish experience. And so, as part of her bequest, she has tasked Jewish Studies to help in ways that we've yet to think about. We've been brainstorming for several days, to further the study of, spread the knowledge about, and highlight the accomplishments of Ramonio Jews, particularly in the United States, but not only there. Now, Marcia, our guest, is not Ramonio Jewish. She's Greek Jewish in her heritage. She grew up in Brooklyn. She attended the same high school and college that Steve Weiland did, Erasmus High School and Brooklyn College. And then later on in life, she returned to school for graduate work at Queens College, where she studied Italian and Greek. She has been the museum director of Kehillah Kedosha Yanina for the last 8 years. She has mounted many historical exhibits at the museum. She also sits on the a board of the historic board that oversees and contributes to the restoration of the New York's Lower East Side. She's very active in that whole area. And she has given many papers and done many translations in connection with the history of Ramonio Jewry on the one hand and Greek Jewry on the other hand. She also, for any of you who may be interested, annually takes, during the summer, a group of people, tourists, to go visit Jewish Greece each summer. She can tell you more about where they go and how they go, and we were learning about it today. I asked her to come because we wanted to pick her brain for as long as we could sit with her, which we've been doing, and because she can tell us more about the history of this distinctive community of Jews who, along with many of our relatives, settled in immigrant America at the turn of the century. Ramonio Jewry on New York's Lower East Side.
I don't know which mic I'm going to be at. I'm good. Okay. I want to thank you, Professor Walter, the Judaic Studies Department here, for inviting me. I'm truly honored. I always like to know my audience before I start. Are there any Greek Jews in the audience? I didn't think so. Are there any Greek Orthodox Christians in the audience? Bravo. Kalos ilthete. It's a pleasure having you here. Let me make sure I've got this right here. Okay. I'm going to be talking about a very special community, the Ramonio Jewish community of the Lower East Side. But before I talk specifically about the Lower East Side, I want to educate those of you who may not know anything about Ramonio Jews, which is probably the entire audience. Okay, why am I not getting? To go forward? That way, okay. Okay, we're all familiar with the terms, or most of us are familiar with the terms Ashkenazim and Sephardim. These are actually geographical terms denoting where Jews came from in German lands, which is what Ashkenazi means, although we more closely associate Ashkenazi with Jews that came from Eastern Europe as German Jews moved east into what is now Poland and Russia, the Ukraine. Sephardi has a different history. It actually comes from the Hebrew and means Spanish. But under the ever-growing umbrella category of Sephardic Jews, it now encompasses all those Jews that are not Ashkenazi, whether they come from Persia, Iraq, Yemen, Ethiopia. The Romano Jews are under this category, and I always kid around that if any of the lost tribes show up, they'll give them to us too. The term Romaniot is coined by the scholars to denote Jews that came from the Eastern Roman Byzantine Empire. Jews lived throughout the lands that now encompass the modern country of Greece. They lived in on the shores of the Mediterranean. Coming back from the Babylonian exile, Jews established communities along the shores. Along the shores of the Mediterranean. So throughout this area here, we found remnants of synagogues that, going back to Ephesus and Turkey, in the Aegean on the island of Delos, certainly in Salonika, there's even the remains of a Samaritan cemetery there. In the early 4th century, when Constantine the Great moved the capital of the Roman Empire from Rome to a city on the Bosphorus named Byzantion, that's where we get Byzantine from. Got to remember, the Byzantines, as they were called afterwards, never called themselves that. They called themselves Romans. They considered themselves, according to them, the Roman Empire did not collapse. It continued in the East. It wasn't until 1453, with the fall of Constantinople, that it then was the fall of, to them, the Roman Empire. Of course, Constantine the Great, humble soul that he was, renamed the city after himself, the city of Constantine. And Jews were citizens of the Roman Empire, so they called themselves Romans, Romaniotes. You can see with the Byzantine Empire here, this encompassed at the height of Byzantium. This was the Byzantine Empire. It extended throughout Italy, throughout what is now Greece, now Turkey, into areas that encompass Iraq, Iran, down Eretz Israel was part of the Byzantine Empire, along the coast here, going into North Africa, going into throughout much of what the Roman Empire was. And of course, the Roman Empire was basically what the classical Greek Empire was. And my feeling is that the term Romaniot, if we think of language, you know, most of us take language for granted. We all grow up learning a language. Some of us are more fortunate, we know more than one language. Language not only is a means of communication, in many instances, it defines us and it separates us. Romaniot Jews were Hellenized, Greek-speaking Jews, who, like Jews throughout history, living predominantly in surrounded by a non-Jewish world, would absorb the culture, traditions, and certainly the language of the world around them. For Hellenized Romaniot Jews, this world was a Greek world, whether it was going back to antiquity, whether it was in Byzantium, or in a continuation as the Ottoman Empire took over. I often say, if you were at the foothills of the Acropolis in Athens during the classical period, there is the remnants of a synagogue there in the Agora, right in the center of the market. So Jews had a very prominent position in that world. The pagan Greeks would go up to the top of the Acropolis to make sacrifices in their temple. The Jews would go to worship in their synagogue on Shabbat. Other than certain things in their dietary laws, you probably could not tell a Greek pagan from a Greek Jew. Their outfits would be very much the same. Certainly the language they spoke would be identical. This is an actual tombstone, one of the earliest tombstones found from the Greek Jewish world. And as you can see, the name is written in actually Greek. Greek was the lingua franca of the Mediterranean. Greek was spoken, I mean, if you look at the inscriptions on the ancient synagogue in Ostia Antica in Italy, the inscriptions are in Greek. In the catacombs in Rome, the inscriptions on the Jewish tombstones were in Greek. The naming customs of Romano Jews are fascinating. These, you have to remember, these were traditional Jews who named their children the way Jews named their children. Surnames, where there certainly were surnames amongst the Romanyotes that had nothing to do with Judaism, Hellenized names like Batinos, which means to stuff, probably someone who had the occupation of stuffing mattresses, Kofinas, which means little basket, so the patriarch of that family probably made baskets at some point. You can see the Hellenized endings, the os endings at the name. One of my favorite Greek Jewish names is Bechoropoulos. Bechor comes from the Hebrew, the firstborn son. Poulos is the son of the firstborn son. Hajopoulos, a Hajj amongst Muslims, they made a Hajj to Mecca. Amongst Christians, Greek Christians, they would make their Hajj to Constantinople. And amongst Greek Jews, their Hajj would be to Yerushalayim. So the son of someone who made a pilgrimage was Hajopoulos. And it was a name that was also Christian or Jewish. Naming their children in Yanunum, the traditional naming practices, most of the surnames originated as male Hebrew first names. So you have many Solomons, many Baruchs, many Samuels, many Naphtalis. Let me get this straight right away. People accuse Sephardic and Romano Jews, my Ashkenazi friends, whenever I speak, oh, you name after the living. You know what? There is nothing in Jewish tradition as to naming your children. It's not that we name after the living. We honor our mother and father. And what can be a greater honor than bestowing their names on your children? And you hope they're alive to experience this honor. In the community of Yanina that we figure at its height, at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, there were maybe 4,000 Jews, half of whom would wind up emigrating, leaving between 1902 to 1924. So you had a small community. You had, for instance, Samuel had a son. His son's name was Solomon. This was Solomon ben Samuel. Now, when Solomon had a son, he would name it after his father. And the son would be Samuel ben Solomon. Solomon ben Samuel. It kept going back and forth. The Ottoman Turks were going crazy. They said you have to have one surname in the family. So the Greek Jews and Yanina said, of course, no problem. And then they went about naming their children the way they always did. But what happened is you had so many that had the same names because you had large families. And in all likely, all the Samuels that named their first son Solomon, who were naming it after their father, they had many other cousins who also named their sons the same way. How do you distinguish one Solomon ben Samuel from another? So they had what became paratchoukla. They were nicknames. Now the paratchoukla were very interesting in Yanina because they weren't always complimentary. You had one that was vovos, which means like deaf and dumb. Then you had some that would be physical descriptions. Galenos, somebody who had blue eyes. Platinos, somebody who had their shop under the plane tree. Actually, Ada's great-grandfather acquired his paratchoukla kochemero from the Hebrew prayer that is said when you're cleaning the house of leavened products at Pesach, the kalkamira prayer. And what it is, it's a prayer that said that separates these things you can have from the things you cannot have, the leavened products from the unleavened products. And the people would tease Jesula Mattathias, which was actually his surname, that you're so picky in picking out your fabrics, it's as if you're saying the Kalkamira prayer. So his nickname, his Parasukla, became Kalkamira, and in the United States, it became Colchimera. Jews of Byzantium, in many ways, had a very blessed existence in comparison to Jews elsewhere in the diaspora. They were allowed to own land, engage in most occupations. There were some restrictions as far as items of clothing they could not wear. And it's interesting because both in Byzantium and in the Ottoman Turkish Empire, Jews were not allowed to ride horses because this way you were higher than the rulers, whether they be Christian or Muslim. These are traditional dresses of Byzantine Jews. And usually underneath the various types of turbans that they would wear would be the kippah they would wear underneath. According to oral history, the Jews first settled in Yanunar at the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 of the Common Era. According to the oral history, they were taken as slaves by the Romans on their way to Rome, and one of the slave ships was forced to land off the western coast of Greece. And the good-hearted captain allowed them to disembark, and they made their way up to Yanunar. I used to poo-poo this story all the time. I'm quite familiar with that part of Greece. Modern times now, with new roads, it's a good four-hour drive from the city of Igoumenitsa up to Yanunar. This is after cutting through the mountains, putting tunnels through, and new roads. At the time we're talking about, it would have taken them weeks to get up there. They would have had to be mountain goats. And why would they go? There's not even any record of any city then. I met a couple of years ago a fascinating man who's an Albanian archaeologist who invited me to Albania because they had found the shipwrecks of boats that were forced to land off the southern coast of Albania on the strait between Albania and Corfu. There was no Albania until 1913. So that western coast would have been Albania, not Greece. And they could have walked straight across to Yanunar. So now it gave some credence to this oral history. Of course, the first mention of Jews is not until the 8th century. And this is actually in church archives where it lists a Jewish family that are by law ordered to be custodians of the Greek Orthodox Church. After the influx of Sephardic Jews in 1492, Yanunar would be one of the few communities in Greece that remained Roman Yod. For those of you who are not familiar with the expulsion of Jews from Spain, the expulsion order went into effect actually the end of July 1492. Ferdinand and Isabella were kind-hearted because it coincided with the 9th of Av, and so they allowed the Jews to be out. They extended the time until the 2nd of August. And at that time, it's estimated that anywhere between 200,000 to 400,000 Jews were affected. We don't have exact numbers. Census was very different then than it is now. We know that the majority of those Jews came into parts of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. The Ottoman Turks took over the Byzantine Empire starting in 1430 and with the fall of Constantinople in 1453, for the most part, much of what was Byzantium was now Ottoman Turkish. The good-hearted Sultan Bayezid II extended an invitation. I say good-hearted facetiously because he actually wasn't doing this for any altruistic reasons. Literally, a rabbi whispered in his ears, a Roman Yod rabbi, by the way, and said, don't be a fool. Take advantage of the fact that the Ferdinand is expelling these people. They will be of value to you in your empire. Going back then, in 1492, Sephardic Jews in Spain already had a reputation of being experts in maritime mercantile trade. So they were invited in, or they were given ships that they could come into the Ottoman Turkish Empire. much of which there were Jewish, pre-existing Romano-Jewish communities there at that time. In Salonika alone, there were 20,000 Jews that came in 1492. Yanina, being in the west of Greece, on the other side of the Pindos mountain range, was not affected by the immediate influx of Sephardic Jews. Within two generations, most of the indigenous Greek-speaking Romano Jews were absorbed into the Sephardic world for a number of reasons. The Sephardim were more cultured, more cosmopolitan. They brought learned rabbis with them. Once printing was established in Salonika, they were printing the Jewish prayer books, the Siddurim. And I can say this, because I come from the Sephardic world, they had a bit of an attitude. According to Jewish tradition, if you come into a Jewish community, you're supposed to observe the rituals and customs of that Jewish community. And the Romano Jews of Salonika invited the Sephardic Jews to join their congregation, even though they would have been so overcrowded. But the Sephardic Jews looked down upon these Greek Jews. They called them Grekos, which was a derogatory term. They looked down upon the Ashkenazi Jews. They called their synagogue La Sinagoga de los Locos, the crazy synagogue. But they were so numerous and so sophisticated, and then they were also given certain privileges by the Ottoman Turkish Empire because they were invited rather than conquered, enabling the Sephardic Jews to really overpower the indigenous Romano Greek Jewish world. This is a picture from Yanina. How many of you have been to Greece? How many of you have been to Yanina? You missed the most beautiful part. Although any Greek you speak to, if you ask them where they came from the best part of Greece. And in most instances, they're right. Yanina, this picture was actually taken in the 1940s. It's frozen in time. In the early morning mist, as the mist rises up over the lake, it's a very mystical experience. And I often take my morning walks then. It hasn't changed. It still looks the same as this. Living in relative isolation, the Jews west of the Pindos mountain range kept their distinctive traditions and culture. Their liturgical language is called Judeo-Greco and was a mixture of Greek and Hebrew. Their spoken language was a mixture of Greek, Hebrew, and Turkish, with some Italian and Spanish words brought by Jews who entered the community from Italy and Spain. An expression that I love was Mashallah, Nasas rixo totaleth. God willing, I shall see you wrapped in the talith. Or God willing, I'll live to see you get married. It's the wish of every Jewish parent, you know? Their clothing, their traditional clothing, was very distinct. And I've researched the costumes of the Jews of Yanina. We have some beautiful costumes on display in our museum. They were not the same as were worn by either the Turks or the Greeks at the time that they were there. They were their own variations on the costumes of the period. This is a traditional wedding dress from Yanina. Now, every Jewish woman would have her head covered with a decorative scarf. There were layers. By the way, these were all handmade, and there was gold thread that was spun through the wedding dress. The seamstress who created the wedding dress was a guest of honor in the house. When she entered, they would throw gold coins at her feet, and she would live with the family as she was creating the bridal dress. She had a big responsibility, because if the marriage failed, which was almost unheard of in Yanina, she was blamed. The liturgical, we had to blame somebody, right? This is an example of the liturgical language, the Judeo-Greco that was used in the prayer books. Now, what's interesting amongst the Jews of Yanina, up until Yanina became part of modern Greece in 1913, they would write their Greek using Hebrew characters. And this is an example of a tombstone that was recently discovered in the Jewish cemetery in Yanina. This tombstone actually dates from 1426, and it's Aaron Halevi, a rabbi. We have found tombstones, other tombstones from the 15th century. They are now the oldest tombstones in all of Greece, and the Jewish cemetery in Yanina is now an historical landmark. The Jews of Yanina also were involved in silver making, and they created magnificent filigree cases to hold the Megillat Esther. Purim was a very special holiday in Yanina. You know, Purim is a very joyous holiday. It's a celebration of the saving of Jews and the story of Esther, the heroine who saved Jews. Many Jewish communities commemorate a second Purim that has to do specifically with their community that was saved. And amongst the Yanoti Jews, or Jews from Yanina, there were a group that came from Sicily and brought with them their own Purim that speaks about the saving of the Jews of Siracusa in Sicily. And we can see by certain surnames some of these Jews that came from Sicily, Kantos, which is Italian for song and probably was the name of a hazan or a cantor. Messina, certainly after the city of Messina, and Dosti, which was a very Italian Jewish name. We are going to be reinstituting the reading of this special Megillah at Purim that takes place in the spring around Shavuot. This is an example of the case. This one is magnificent. It's been photographed all over and appeared in magazines all over the world. We have a collection of these in our museum collection. The reason we have so many is it was a traditional gift that was given by the groom's family to the couple on their first Purim. So every family had one. But if you were very wealthy, you had one like this. If you were poor, you had a simple one. And sometimes I'm fonder of the simple ones than I am of the more elaborate ones. We still use these Megillas, and we still read from them during our Purim. Another distinctive custom of the Jews from Yanina is what is known as an Aleph. Aleph is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And this was an amulet that was created at the Brit Milah, or the circumcision, of a male child, where that's when a Jewish boy receives his name, and the name would be written on the bottom. We found Alephs in Yanina, Arta, Prevesa, which are two close by communities to Yanina, and on the island of Corfu. The tradition was brought over to the United States, but seemed to die out in the 1930s. This is an example of an Aleph, and let me explain to you. You have here, you have the Ten Commandments, of course. This is the Shema Israel, which is one of the holiest prayers in Judaism. The 67th Psalm, which is inside the menorah, which is to protect the Jewish child. You have the names of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. And you have a number of Kabbalistic prayers in the hands of the Kohanim. We had a Kabbalist who came into our synagogue to explain to us the Aleph. We got more confused than anything by the time he got finished. And he said, this was a very spiritual, mystical community. And I'm laughing. This was a simple, uneducated community. My feeling, and of course there's no way to substantiate this, is there must have been a male infant that was sick. Somebody wandered into the town, created this amulet with all these prayers. They hung it over the baby's cradle, which, by the way, was the tradition. And the baby got better. It worked. Why not keep doing it? You know, infant mortality was very prevalent for many, many centuries. We are thinking of reviving this tradition, but we run into arguments now. Can we create one for the girls, too? In this community that knows nothing about being equalitarian, no. It's still very traditional Orthodox. The women worship separate from the men. The Jewish community of Yanina in the early 20th century was a conservative, observant, and patriarchal community. From 1902 to 1924, half the Jewish community immigrated, most to New York City. They left the streets of Yanina, the traditional Jewish world of that time. This picture was actually taken in 1906, and it's a rabbi. And you can see by the houses, the Turkish-style houses, these balconies, you know, architects in these small communities, they use the architectural style that was the architectural style of the surrounding non-Jewish world. There were few Jewish architects in these communities, few Jews involved in the trade of building houses. So the houses reflected the community they lived alongside. The balconies were very Muslim because the Muslim Turkish women would not come down into society. They would stay up on the balcony, and there were actually screens there that they would lift up and look in the outside world. Of course, the Jews did not practice this, but their houses were the same, and the Christian houses were also the same as this. Family photos. I am obsessed with photos for a very personal reason. I don't have any. Unfortunately, with the tremendous destruction in my family in the Holocaust, we were left with one family photo. It became a common practice to take a professional photo to send to those that had already left to come to the New World. And photos of those who were not present were incorporated into the family photo. This is an example. This is the David family of Yanina, and you can see by the style of dress, the men were wearing, this picture was from the very early 20th century. It was probably sent over to the United States around 1903. The men were still wearing the turbans. The women were dressed, of course, Jewish, Greek Jewish women, the same as Greek Christian women. You lose somebody in the family, you're in black the rest of your life. She's holding a picture of her daughter, who had married a man and was living in Constantinople. It's a family picture. The daughter has to be part of the family picture. So she's holding the photo. This is also was a very Greek Christian custom of the period. This one here, you may actually know the family. I don't know how many of you have heard of Sid Gannis. He was head of the Academy of Arts and Sciences for a period of time. And this is Sid's family from Greece. And again, holding the pictures of family members who had come over. This is the family of Rabbi Bekoraki Matzel. And I love these pictures with the children. You know, it took so long to take these pictures. We have a name for this expression. It's called the mutra, you know? And I mean, you just know what was going through this child's mind and what probably preceded the taking of this picture. A couple of slaps, like stand still. And Bekoraki Matzel came to the United States. He became a rabbi in our community in New York. This picture was such a find. Jesula Cochimero, Ada Finifter's grandfather, I was obsessed with the fact, I mean, in this community where there were such large families, I mean, we knew Jesula himself had 11 children. What about the siblings of Jesula? We couldn't find any until a friend of mine sent me this picture. And this is meet Dina Cochimero, who was Jesula Cochimero's sister. She married into the Gannis family. And it wasn't until I received this picture that we found a sibling. We since have found two other siblings. This is also relatives of Ada's cousins in her family from the Eliezer family. And this was very typical photographs that would be taken. And of course, the photographer would have to have his logo on the bottom. But it gives you the style of dress, the use of the turban, and the style of dress of the period. Most of the families were large families. This is the Svolis family. And this family was unfortunately terribly devastated during the Holocaust. Almost everyone in this picture was lost. But large, large families. And this family was blessed with the fact of many sons. Those that had many daughters were crippled by the fact that they had to provide dowries for their daughters. This is one of my favorite photos, simply because when I received it, it was in such disrepair. And God bless the man I work with on photoshopping. This is one of the few photos of a very, very famous Greek-Jewish poet from Yanina, Joseph Elia. And here he is as a three-year-old boy. He was a member of the Negrin family. And how beautifully the furs came out and the designs on the costumes. And this jewelry were traditional wedding gifts that were given to the women. So you see they're all wearing this particular type of jewelry. Furs were used on the inside to keep you warm. I mean, Yanina's up in the mountains. And every fur was used. If you were wealthy, you had mink or fox. If you weren't that wealthy, you had rabbit. If you were really poor, you had cat. And this is one of my favorite pictures. This is from the Eliezer family. Also, these were cousins of Ada Phidippus' family. This woman here, Eva, had come to the United States, and this is her engagement picture that was sent back 1920 to the family. So they photoshopped her into the picture. And if you look, she's very modern looking, where the rest of the family is not. From the Kantos family, I just love this picture because I love this Sarah's picture over here. And, you know, we have this wealth of pictures because our people from Yanina brought them over, or they were sent these pictures. And so often in other communities, they don't have the pictures because of the devastation in the Holocaust. So much was lost. But we have this wealth, these magnificent pictures. The world the Yanoti Jews left behind was quite different from the world they would find in New York. They traded the fresh mountain air for the cramped quarters of the tenements. They left to find better opportunities for themselves and their children. And they carried with them their traditions and customs. And unlike Jews from Eastern Europe, they carried with them a love for the land they were leaving behind. This is something my Ashkenazi Jews have difficulty understanding. When I speak about the immigrant experience, I speak to the fact that leaving is always, you're tearing your roots up. Whether you choose to leave, whether you're forced to leave, it's a disrupting situation. It's an emotional situation. You're leaving a world behind. At this time when these immigrants came over, in all likelihood, they were never going to go back again. That long journey coming over. They pack their suitcases. They pack their big trunks. They take with them their clothing, their religious artifacts. They take with them their memories. And for Eastern European Jews, they took with them the stories of pogroms and persecutions. For our community, they took with them a love for the land they were leaving behind. When I speak to my Eastern European Ashkenazi friends or groups that come into the synagogue, I say, how many of you would identify yourself as a Ukrainian Jew or a Russian Jew or a Polish Jew? No. Most of them have never gone back. Their families left and had no desire to ever return. Our community proudly identifies ourselves as Greek Jews. We're proud of our religion. We're proud of our Greekness, and we see no conflict in the two terms. The Jews from Yanina would come to the United States, and they would bring their Torah scrolls with them. We have in our own synagogue, we actually have three Torah scrolls that come from Yanina. These Torah scrolls are encased in what are known as tikkim. And this is a perfect example of Judeo-Greco. Teak comes from the Greek word theke, case. Im is the Hebrew plural. Synagogue comes from the Greek, synagogi. We read from the bima, which comes from the Greek word vima, a raised platform. This is not a coincidence. Greeks and Jews have the longest continuous interaction of any two civilizations, or of the two civilizations that were most instrumental in creating Western civilization. We've lived alongside of each other for millennia. We haven't always necessarily gotten along with each other. We're too much alike. The life of Jews in Yarmouth centered around the market. Most of the Jews owned small shops, many involved in some aspect of the textile trade. There was no mass production of textiles in Greece at that time. There were no factories. Clothing was made in the home. So Jesula Kotchamera bought and sold fabrics. There were other Jews that had small shops that would sell dry goods. They would sell buttons, needles, threads. They would travel throughout the Mediterranean selling their wares. Ada Finnerty's great-grandfather, Jesula, bought and sold fabrics. And with this income, he raised 11 children. This is the marketplace in Yannina at the beginning of the 20th century. Jews started to leave Yannina at the beginning of the 20th century. Why did they leave? You know, people say to me, oh, if life was so great, why did they leave? Political unrest. There were two wars, the Balkan Wars, before World War I. Few opportunities. There was few means to climb up the social ladder. If your father was a butcher, you were going to be a butcher. If your father was a water carrier, you were going to carry water for a living. The dowry system was crippling. You know, the dowry in Greece had to be outlawed in 1982. Outlawed, because it was so crippling on poor families that had many daughters. There was an antiquated inheritance system where everybody, all the siblings, inherited equally. Picture being a young man that wants to start out in life. With this pittance, how are you going to start out? So they came for economic opportunities. Some made Aliyah and went to Eretz Israel. There was a very strong Zionist movement in Yannina. What always surprised me is how this little remote community off the beaten track had a street that was actually named after a Zionist, Max Nordo, in the Jew. I mean, picture this in Greece in the early 20th century, Max Nordo Street. The world they left behind was quite different from the world they found in New York City. This was the world they left behind. Oxen in the street, unpaved streets, simple shops that they made their living. This is a tavern that was owned by a Greek Jew in Yannina. The community was very cohesive in Greece. It was a small community. Everybody was related to everybody else, either through blood or through marriage. The whole community would come out for a wedding. They left their Turkish-style homes with their ornate balconies for the tenements of New York City. This is a Jewish wedding in Yannina. They filled the streets. There was no, you know how the invitation was sent out? There was a crier that went through the Jewish quarter and called out, Eftekia Nachman and Mordecai Solomon are getting married. The wedding takes place at such and such time, and the whole community would be there. The simplicity of life in Yannina, by the way, women had a very sheltered life. Ada was an extremely educated, bright woman. The Jewish women of Yannina did not get any education until 1906 when the Alliance Israelite Universelle, which was a French-based Jewish educational system, came into Yannina, and then they learned French and how to sew. If Ada's family had not left, even into modern times, well, Ada wouldn't even have been here. Her family would have been lost in the Holocaust. But if they had survived, they still would have led a very sheltered life. Women did not work. It was considered a disgrace. It meant your father couldn't support you or your husband couldn't support you. So when I did up the memorial book for the Jewish community of Yonada, which really showed the composition of the community back in 1944, out of a community of 2,000, there were only 5 professionals. There were 2 teachers, one of whom happened to be a woman. There was a pharmacist. There was a doctor. And actually, there were 6. There were 2 lawyers. Now, don't ask me why they needed 2 lawyers in this small community, but there's never enough lawyers. Not all the Jewish community left. Half the Jewish community of Yonada remained, and 91% of the 1944 community was lost in the Holocaust. Among them was one branch of the Cultumero family. Danula Cultumero married to the Bacola family, and practically the whole Bacola family would be lost in the Holocaust. These are some of the children, distant cousins of Ada's, who were perished in the Holocaust. Most of the Jews from Yonada who immigrated to New York left Greece between 1902 and 1924. Most of the Yanoti Jews sailed from the port of Patras. They sailed on crowded ships, most third class, in the hulls of the boats. This is in Patras. They would load the immigrants into these little boats that would take them to the ship that was leaving. By the way, these ships originated in Trieste, which was then under the Austro-Hungarian Empire. They made their way down to Patras. Then they would usually stop in Naples and Palermo before, 3 weeks later, they would arrive in New York. You know, I can just picture the dialogue, looking at the ship manifests and all the misspellings and the fact that whoever was writing down the names had no idea what these Jews and Greeks were saying, because I can see up in Trieste, they're saying, okay, who here on ship speaks Greek? Someone has to be there to write down the names in the port. And the names will be written down. We have one family that came over, and the name is Patera. Now, in Greek, Patera means father. So I can just picture the dialogue at the port of Patras, getting on the ship. What's your name? Patera. Okay, Patera. That became the family surname. Mistakes were not made at Ellis Island. All Ellis Island did was take the names off the ship manifest and transcribe them. So any errors that were made at the port where they embarked. This is a taken from a ship that carried Greek immigrants. And this picture I love because look how protective the father is of the women folk behind him. He's actually lying across. They were in the hulls of the ship. To get fresh air, they would come up on top. These were sheltered women who really had very little contact with men that they were not related to. And the father wanted to make sure it stayed that way. They passed through Ellis Island, claimed by a relative or friend, and found themselves in a bustling, crowded city, not understanding the languages spoken around them. This was the immigrant experience. As difficult as it was, they persevered. Few Jews left the New World to return to Europe. They came to stay. Where there would be other immigrants who said, well, you know, the Italians, many of them came to make enough money to go back to Italy, and there were those that did. There were also in the Greek Christian world, there were those that the men would come over to work, they would make enough so they could go back and make a better life for their families back in Greece. Where there were Greek Jews that did return, it was usually to bring additional family members over. They would wade through immigration, and, you know, the examination, especially the eye examination, was so frightening because if you were found to have pink eye, you weren't allowed to come in. Most of the community initially settled on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in the area of Broom and Allen Street, the heart of the Balkan Jewish world. The tenements they settled in were built in 1890. Most apartments contained 2 rooms, often holding up to 14 people. Most extended family, but often boarders that would help pay the rent. I have a friend of mine, Shirley, that lives in a beautiful house down in Boca Raton in Florida. And I say to her, Shirley, don't put on airs with me. I know where you came from. Because her grandfather had a 2-room apartment on Eldridge Street. And living in that apartment, was he and his wife and six children, his mother-in-law, his mother and father, a sister, a brother, and two boarders. And that was common. These were the tenements they moved into, and you know, they don't look much different now. Being involved in historic landmarking, we want to create an historic district. Okay, this was the 2nd Avenue L that was torn down. And this building here faced what is now Allen Street. But these buildings, and you can tell by the style of architect, these cornices and these descriptive decorations show that the building was from 1890. You can date the building by the different architectural decorations that are on them, and we're very fortunate that most of the buildings on our block have not lost their cornices, because that's a very distinctive sign, and it really takes away from the architectural integrity of what may possibly become an historic district. Different laws that were put into place. These buildings, initially when they were built, replaced old-style tenements that had outhouses. Those outhouses were outlawed, and when these buildings were built, they initially had at the end of the hallway a bathroom that the whole floor would share. Then bathrooms were put, they had to be put into individual apartments. So there were whole different processes. There was a law, now this building we can tell at the time that it was built, it was, if it had been built a decade before, being a corner building, there would have had to be a space left between that building and the building next to it for fire escapes. That law was discontinued. You know, the phrase cross ventilation, I think, was created by Jews in the tenements, because many of these apartments, if you had one window, you were lucky. Have two windows on either side that you would get some air coming through? You were a king. They lived up on the roofs. During the summertime, the roof became their beach. They'd go up there, they'd play cards up on the roof. Family photos would be taken up on the roof because it'd get nice scenery in the background. This is some more of the tenement buildings, and these pictures were actually taken with the filing in 1937. But they haven't really changed at all. The standard thing would be four apartments on each floor, and there were four floors. So this is four floors, and then a store in the bottom. The only thing that's really changed is the stores on the bottom that are now are different. The apartments were filled with treasures brought over from Greece, many of the items from the wives' dowry, and our museum is filled with these family heirlooms. The tenement kitchens were small and primitive by today's standards, but the Greek delicacies created were superb. The kouloudia, the patrajan, the bamias, the pastelia are still eaten by Yanoti Jews. This is a typical apartment in a tenement. And you can see, you know, these cramped quarters, the stove. Could you imagine having to cook on one of these now? The beautifully embroidered items that they would bring over and to decorate the apartments. The women, God bless them, they tried to do the best they could with these very meager quarters to make as attractive as possible the homes that they were raising their children in. This is an example of one of our artifacts from the museum, and this is a vest, an ornate vest that was part of the traditional costumes of the Jews of Greece. Packed into their luggage, they brought over with them these treasures that they weren't going to wear here in the New World, but they had sentimental meaning for them. They were either part of their dowry items, or something like this might have been worn by a child in the family. And I'm so grateful they brought them over. This is a typical tenement kitchen. You know, these tables, this is a fairly more affluent family, because very often the kitchen table was a plank of wood that was put on top of what would be used as the bathtub. And when you needed a bath during a time when it was warm enough in the house, because there were times that they would keep coal in the bathtub to use to heat up the apartment. Everything was multifunctional. The beds never got cold. because when one shift got up to go to work, the shift that was working during the day would come in to lie down at night. The beds were constantly recycled. The Enoti Jews found themselves surrounded by Jews and non-Jews from all over Europe. Not speaking Yiddish, they were often scorned by the Ashkenazim, who doubted that they were Jewish. How could you be Jewish if you don't speak Yiddish? They were also looked down by the Sephardim. I laugh. Out of 400, actually, we were the 404th synagogue built in existence on the Lower East Side in 1927. We are now one of only five original Jewish houses of worship that are still functioning as a synagogue. The Ashkenazim doubted that this community was Jewish. The Sephardim around the corner looked down upon them because they were Grecos. Guess what? They're not there anymore. We still are. This is one of my favorite pictures. This is a Fani, Jenny, typical picture of the Lower East Side, and doing her laundry out the window. These are Yanoti Jews in the Allen Street Park. This was right on Allen Street. They had the benches out there. This was their park. They would wheel the baby characters, the older carriages. The older people would gather to sit and to talk. And this was their world. Ada Finifta's family were among those who came from Yanina, Greece, to find their fortunes in the New World. Her grandfather, Leon Cochimero, was one of the founders of the synagogue. Leon was also instrumental in helping many of his brothers and sisters establish themselves in the New World. Leon would be the one who would pick the brothers and sisters up at Ellis Island. His name would appear on the ship manifest. Where are you going? We're going to Leon Cochimero. By the way, there were such lies on those ship manifests. And no one, they didn't care. All they cared about when you got on the ship in Patras is if you had enough money on you and if you were in good health. Because if you weren't in good health, the ship company would have to pay for your return. When you got to the New World, they didn't care that you lied about your age. You know, how much things have changed. They didn't care that there were 40 people on the ship that all said they were going to Leon Cochimero. Where was, how were they going to have? They didn't care. Someone was there to pick them up. They mentioned names of people they were going to who weren't even alive anymore. This is actually Ada Finifta's family. This is her grandfather, Leon Cochimero, and this is his wife, Sarah. This is Ada's mother, Stella. And these are her aunts and uncles. And Morris Cochimero is the father of three members of our present board, Leonard, Elliot, and Jesse. The Enoti Jews were proud of being Jewish and proud of being Greek, and like most immigrants of that period, wanted to become American. They took professional pictures to send home to Greece to show how they succeeded. They proudly served in the U.S. Armed Forces in both the First and the Second World Wars. This is Avasai Gani, who became quite prosperous, by the way, and what a lovely New Year card he sent back to Greece to rub it in how well he had done, you know? This is the Moses family, and I love this picture, the elegance of the women. These outfits were, this one in the back here, definitely was rented. They would rent outfits to take these pictures. This was very common amongst the immigrants. You're sending a picture back to Greece, you want to look like you're succeeding. This is actually from the Politis family, and this man served in the United States Armed Forces in World War I. And this is one of my favorite World War I photos. This was a group of young men from the Lower East Side went to send off their friend Solomon Shorty Matzah, who was going over to fight in Europe in World War I. So I said to Maxi Nachmias, and this is his father Sam here, I said, how short was Shorty? I mean, in a community, all these men were so short. How short must Shorty have been to acquire this nickname? And Maxie said he was short. I found out from his granddaughter he was so short that he had to stand on a crate next to his wife for the bridal photos. But he might have been short, but he was much loved and full of spirit. This is a very, this picture connected us with so many families, because I received this when I was doing my exhibit on Greek Jewish families. I must have gotten 4 copies of this picture, because each one of these here married into another family. This was the Matza family, the Confino family, the Abalafia family, and each one had a copy of this picture, and no one can figure out who this little girl is. They said she must have snuck in the picture. She had to be related to somebody. Initially, they married amongst themselves, but in the generation born in the United States, it became more common to marry into the traditional Sephardic and Ashkenazi world. This is actually from Elias Cochumero, who was an uncle of Elias and Ada's grandfather were brothers, so he would have been a great uncle, right? And he married into the Maza family. This was in 1908 in Manhattan. So he married, stayed within the Yanoti world. And this was also another marriage that were 2 Yanoti families, the Negrin and the Mathios. The Mathio family was related to Ada Finifter. Of course, her great-grandfather's name was Matathias, or Mathios, before it became Cochumero. And I love this one because this was so much the traditions they carried over to the New World. 1924, the wedding is taking place. It's going to be at Clinton Hall on Clinton Street, down on the Lower East Side. But everybody, can you imagine this, is going to gather at the bride's residence at 297 Broome Street, and then go over to the Clinton Street for the wedding. This was what they did in Yanina. This was what they were going to do on the Lower East Side. This is a traditional ketubah from Yanoki Jews, and it was a very elaborate ketubah. A ketubah was a marriage contract. You can think of it as a prenuptial agreement. In the case of the Yanoki Jews, it was what they were bringing into the marriage, and the woman was always spoken about in very flowing terms. She was a fantastic gift that the man was getting by marrying her. Everything the Yanoti Jewish woman brought into the marriage was meticulously written down in the ketubah, because if for some reason the marriage was dissolved, everything went back to her. This is something that stemmed back to Byzantium, where women had more rights than women in other parts of the world. And of course, if she predeceased her husband, that property also would go back to her family. It was a protection for the bride. This is a Cochumero. This is a wedding of 2 Yanoti families. This was the father of the bride, and the bride and her brother got married at the same wedding. The 2 grooms were going over to fight in World War II, and the father said, "I'm going to save myself some money." So he had this double wedding. But if you realize, with the exception of the groom's wife, she was an Ashkenazi Jew, everybody here was related to each other. There were these large families. So this was the Negrin and the Gani family, and you had so many of these people who were direct relatives. The Cochumeros made their way in the growing garment business in New York City, coming together at large family functions like the bar mitzvah of Marvin Cochumero, and I'm going to show you that picture now. Family was all important. This is Marvin Cochumero's bar mitzvah picture. And again, you know, it always amazes me with these pictures. We have all these sophisticated camera equipment now. I mean, you can see this one, it was not in very good condition, but you could see practically everybody in the picture very, very distinctly. This picture was taken in 1937, yeah. These were neighbors of the Cochumeros. This was from the Nachmias family. And these, again, on the Lower East Side, the Nachmias family on the Lower East Side. These were relatives of Ada's from the Abalafia family. The outfits, I just love these outfits. The community of Romano Jews were proud of their religion, but also proud of their Greek ethnicity. The Jews were often invited to attend Greek Orthodox Christian events, and Jews often invited the Christians to their celebration. This is a bar mitzvah. Now, how many bar mitzvah photos will you ever see where there is the Greek flag in the background sitting as a guest of honor at the dais right next to the bar mitzvah boy's father? And the rabbi is the archbishop of the Greek Orthodox Church, Athenagoras, right? We had the opening of our exhibit on the Key Maslos Muestros, Greek Jewish families in Greece and in the United States. The present Archbishop Demetrios came to the opening, and we presented him a copy of this picture. Who presented it to him? The bar mitzvah boy, Irwin Joseph, who, this is from 1937, and Irwin, thank God, is still with us. And on the beamer for the presentation was the grandson of Joe Joseph, also named Joe Joseph, and the grandson of Rabbi Jesula Levy, also named Jesula Levy. So it was quite, we recycle our names, you know. This is a, was an event where the Archbishop Athenagoras was being honored, and again, who's up at the top there with him? You have the rabbi and the archbishop. You know, I often say to people when I show this picture, other than the archbishop and the rabbi, you could not tell who here were Jewish and who were Greek Orthodox. I mean, the affinity of the two communities, that what bound them together was the language. They were Greek speakers, and Greek is such an important part of the Greek identity. One of my most fascinating visits was to a local Greek Orthodox church down on the Lower East Side, St. Barbara's, when I met Father Angelos there. I went to the basement, we were talking, because it's actually in a former synagogue. St. Barbara's is over on Forsyth Street. And I looked at the pictures on the wall of former Greek classes, because Greek Christians send their children to, I'm sure you all remember from my Big Fat Greek Wedding, they all send their children to Greek school, Greek church to learn Greek. Well, I looked at the pictures and I said, Father, do you realize how many of the children in those pictures are Jewish? Because our community would send their children to the local yeshiva to learn their Hebrew and become a bar mitzvah, and they would send their children to the local Greek Orthodox Church to learn their Greek. Excuse me? This was the Broadway Central Hotel. It's no longer in existence. The Greek-Jewish community of the Lower East Side became part of the massive wave of immigration in the early 20th century. Many worked their pushcarts on Orchard Street. Owning a sewing machine made you an entrepreneur. Most established small biz family-owned businesses. Other opened shops under the L and Allen Street. And their sons and daughters would fulfill the American dream and become professionals. This is some of the shops on Orchard Street. This would be a typical scene of the Lower East Side. And this particular picture is from the 1920s, actually. This is one of the families that made good, the Baruch family. They opened up Baruch Brothers, which was a firm that made ladies' bathrobes and nightgowns. And actually, the woman in this picture here, she was a Colchimero. Rachel Colchimero married Benjamin Baruch. Under the L in Allen Street, the number of businesses, and you can see the occupations, this is kimonos, that was house dresses. I mean, nobody wears them anymore, but they were very, very popular. They were simple businesses. I mean, it wasn't very high scale. And you had these shops, Mevorak and Cohn. By the way, I connected with the grandson of Megarak recently. They were not Romano Jews. The family came from Kastoria in Greece. This was Abraham, David, and sons. Kimonos, aprons, bathrobes. I don't know if you remember the David picture that I showed you early on. It was one of the first family pictures that I showed you where men were all wearing turbans. Abraham was in that picture before he came to the United States. Life on the Lower East Side, the pleasures were simple, the family was everything, life centered around their synagogue and their community. This picture was taken right across the street from our synagogue. Everybody gathered on the, they brought their chairs out. There weren't stoops on these buildings like we had in Brooklyn, but they would take their chairs out and they'd sit outside. The babies would be walked in the carriage. They would converse with each other. This was the life. There was no TV. They worked long hours, but always found time for a Greek coffee at one of the local coffee shops, and of course some music and dancing at a local nightclub. This is one of my favorite pictures. These were two, by the way, these are Greek Jews. These are two coffee shops. There was the Central, and then there was the Cafe Nien, the meeting place. And if you went to one coffee shop, God forbid you should set foot into the other coffee shop, you know? And these were Greek Jews because this was on Allen Street, and the Greek Christian coffee shops were further west over on 8th and 9th Street. These are relatives of Ada's. These are two of her. This is Isaac Cohn, who married a great aunt of hers. He was a great uncle of hers. And this is the youngest brother of Leon Colchimero playing the bouzouki. Dancing. You know, I have had Greek Orthodox friends of mine who have come to some of our events and they've been absolutely floored. They say, I can't understand it. You're playing Greek music. You're dancing Greek dances. You're eating Greek food. You're speaking Greek and you're Jewish? The community opened their synagogue in 1927 and named it after the city they came from, Kehela Kedosha Yanina, the Holy Congregation of Yanina. Ada Finifta's grandfather's name is prominently displayed on one of our founder's plaques. This was a picture of the synagogue taken in 1937. This is here, you can see Ada Finifta's grandfather up here. I'll tell you a secret, he wasn't a rabbi. And what happened, we found this out when we were restoring this plaque. At one point, rabbi was crossed out, and then it was put back in again. We decided to leave it back in. And there was another name on the bottom here that was erased. We didn't know whether he didn't give his donation. We don't know what happened, but they erased him off the marble plaque. The Romano Jews from Yanina now celebrate their religion using Torah scrolls from Yanina, and on the occasion of a bar mitzvah, what can be more emotional than the bar mitzvah boy carrying a scroll that once was housed in the synagogue in Greece where his great-grandparents worshiped? These are the Torah scrolls from Kehela Kedosha Yanina, and this scroll over here, this case over here, actually holds our oldest Torah scroll that dates back to the 1750s, and it is one of only three in the world in the traditional Romano style of Torah scroll writing. We use this for bar mitzvahs because how emotions, besides the fact that it's one of our lightest ones and easiest to pick up, because these heavy metal and wood cases are quite difficult to lift, but what can be more emotional than carrying that scroll on your bar mitzvah? This is our synagogue now. And let me finish by inviting you all to join us one day in New York. Please come and visit us. We'd love to have you. And I want to thank you all for having me here and giving me the opportunity to tell you about a world that I love. Ada loved this world. It's a world that she was so proud to belong to. It's a world that I feel can teach us all a very important lesson. Learn who you are. Learn where you came from. You all have stories that are so important. Pass those stories on to your children and your grandchildren. We have a saying on the Lower East Side, we all walk in somebody else's footsteps. Make yours deep so somebody else can walk in yours. Thank you very much. Are we going to do question and answer? Okay, great. It's my favorite part. Question? Go, come up to the microphone and ask me your question. Who's going to be the first one? Okay.
What was the language of study? That is, did they study the sacred texts in Hebrew or in the Septuagint, which was a Greek translation from the 3rd century before the Common Era?
Okay. Very, very good question. The Septuagint is used by, and it actually was a means of spreading Christianity because of the logos, the use of the word. The Siddurim that we use, the Torah scrolls, well, the Torah scrolls are, those are written in Hebrew. And they do not change. It's the same words in every Torah, just the different styles of writing might be different. The Siddurim that we use from Sherith Israel, which was the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue. In Greece, they use a Siddur in all of Greece now. One side is in Greek and the other side is in Hebrew. But it's the Greek that's used is more Byzantine Greek in that, rather than modern Greek. It's an interesting combination, but a good question. For those of you who are not familiar with the Septuagint, it was the first translation of any part of the Hebrew scriptures into any language out of Hebrew and Aramaic, and it was translated into Greek in North Africa and Alexandria, going back to the, it was actually 3 centuries before the Common Era. And where there's a lot of speculation about why there was a translation and the fact that there were 70 that all came up with the same exact translation. In all likelihood, it came from the fact that Greek-speaking Jews, like Jews throughout the diaspora, were losing their ability to read Hebrew. So they needed a translation into the vernacular. And the vernacular of the Eastern Mediterranean was Greek. I know there's got to be more questions out there. Yes?
Well, as you know, have any Remanente Jews in modern times emerged in the entertainment industry?
In the entertainment industry, well, you know, we have Sid Gannis, of course, who was the president of the Academy of Arts and Sciences. And I am in sort of embarrassed to say this, but oh my God, I can't remember his name now. He's a comedian, very coarse, very gross. His family name was Mazer, actually. And I forgot his name. Isn't that terrible? Yes, there was one. Yeah. They, you know, where Jews were very prevalent in entertainment. This community didn't especially go into as different aspects of entertainment. They stayed to trades, basically trades. Yes?
It's an interconnected question. First is, how many members does the show have? And secondly of all, have the Aninos population remain large?
Okay, we never had a paid membership, so it's very hard to talk about membership. In fact, in the 1940s, when the community was at its height on the Lower East Side, was the first time that you had to pay for a seat at the high holidays. And it had nothing to do with raising money, it had to do with crowd control, because there were only a limited number of spaces, and if you didn't buy your seat, you had to go walk across the Williamsburg Bridge, and there was a makeshift hall that they would rent out for the overflow. We still do not have a membership. We have a mailing list that goes out to about 3 households throughout the United States and about 500 internationally. There are a natural minion in the neighborhood if everybody shows up for Shabbat services, but most of the time our minion is supplemented by people who come from the outer boroughs or the low, close by Connecticut, Westchester, Long Island, New Jersey. It's a spiritual community, and special events, many come back to the synagogue. There's also, I find, I'm most aware of it at Rosh Hashanah, that Jewish New Year, where we celebrate for 2 days. The first day, we have a nice turnout. But the second day, we have a packed house. Why? The first day, many went to synagogues that they belonged to in their neighborhoods, wherever they may live, but they bought a seat, they're a member of that congregation. And then they come to us the second day, because, you know, something was missing. It's not like they remember it when they were growing up. The style of chanting was different. So they come back to us to get that visceral experience of being in a synagogue that reminds them of how they grew up. There's an excellent book that was written about called Hidden Places, Hidden New York, Places That Matter, and we appear in the book. And Marcy Raven, the author, talks about a place that matters. Now, we all have personal places that matter to us, that bring, that conjure up memories when we were growing up. It might have been a camp that we went to, a school that we went to. For a place to matter, to matter to a community, it has to conjure up these memories for many people. I am never more aware of how important we are that when I have somebody come through our doors, and I can always tell, I could be in the middle of talking to a school group or just standing there, they'll walk in and they'll stop dead in their track and they'll look to a certain spot and tears will form in their eyes. They're remembering where their grandfather sat. They're looking up, remembering where their grandmother sat. And to us, to me, we're a place that matters not only because we're a still functioning synagogue or not only because we have a museum upstairs. We're a place that matters because we are a center, a special place for a whole community of Yanoti Jews throughout the world.
Is the liturgy Romaniot or Sephardi?
Okay. We use the Sidurim from Sherith Israel, but you'd never know it if you were there during our service. Our style of chanting is completely different. I grew up in the traditional Sephardic world where our style of chanting is very melodious. It's like the cantigas from Spain, the romanceros. I used to tease Hi Genia, of blessed memory, our former president. I say, Hi, keep it down. The goats are going to start gathering at the front door. It's a very heavy, mountainous sound to it. It's almost like the songs, the Iparoti songs. You can see what was picked up from the surrounding non-Jewish world, and this is the case throughout the whole world of Judaism. So our style of chanting is very different. Our order of the service, they have to call out, we're now over here, we're now over there, because we'll be flipping back all over the place. And then on certain holidays, especially Purim, there's a whole series of piyutim poetry that's incorporated into the service that's a mixture of Hebrew and Greek. So there, and that's never been written. We have written copies of it. It's an oral tradition, and we have recorded it, and we will be putting out soon CDs of the PU team.
I want to ask you a couple of historical questions. If we were talking about Ashkenazi Jews, we would find in the 1920s Landsmannschaft organizations of people from particular towns, particular regions, sending post-war help to the towns of origin, and maybe even doing it through a higher institution like the Jewish Distribution Committee. And my first question is, was there such a connection between Romanian Jews in the Lower East Side and Janina after World War I? And then secondly, if we were to take a snapshot in 1945-46 after the Holocaust, we would find the same thing, even more organized through this higher level organization like the Joint Distribution Committee. And I'm wondering, was the New York Romanian community involved in the restoration of Janina after?
The connection that the community on the Lower East Side had with the Jewish community of Janina was continuous. From its very inception, from the time the first immigrants came over, they never severed that connection. Their burial society and their sisterhood became the two main institutions that would preserve connections back in the, to the old country. The sisterhood would send over funds for dowries for young girls that could not afford it. After World War I, they didn't go through major Jewish institutions like the Joint. They sent the money directly. I have in our museum a letter that was sent to us by the Jewish community in Yonah in 1927 to our community in New York asking for help in money for matzot at Passover for poor Jews in the community that could not afford it. And of course, the community would send it over. After World War II, our community, again, they had never severed the ties. One of the most emotional experiences I had was a woman who came to Greece with us. She wound up having her son's bar mitzvah in Yanina in 2000. And when Rhonda came back, both her parents were born, came from the Yenoti community of the Lower East Side. And when she came back, she got in touch with her father, and she said, "Oh my God, what an unbelievable place Yanina is. You have to go." He said, "I was there. I was there in 1944. His ship docked in Patras, and it was actually, 1945. His ship had docked in Patras. His mother had said to him, he was in the U.S. Navy, and Louis Levy, and came from right in the corner of Broome and Orchard Street, a family of eight children. He probably enlisted in the Navy because he had to get out of that overcrowded apartment there. And he promised his mother that if he ever got to Greece, he would go up to Yanina and find out what was happening because she had not heard from her family in so long. He jumped ship, made his way up to Yanina from Patras, taking rides with British military, members of the British military, and got there just as word was coming back of what had happened. Just as word was coming back of the destruction in the camps, word was coming back from those who had hidden in the mountains. He made met relatives there, took pictures, which I did a whole article called The Personal Odyssey of Louis Levy for a local Greek magazine, and we had those pictures in an exhibit. And he supposedly came back with all this information to the synagogue, and I can't find any records of it any place in the synagogue. He came back with a list of names of those that had survived. We have that subsequently. We got that list afterwards from other sources. But it never ended. I mean, after the war, our community absorbed survivors. They absorbed survivors after earthquakes in the 1950s. We still have that connection. I go back to Greece every year. Even though my roots are in Salonika, my heart is in Yanina. I go back there so we can open the door of the synagogue and enable these Jews to worship, where without our presence, they would not be able to. I go back to bring simchas there. We're having our third bar mitzvah there this June. We celebrated one in 2000, one in 2007. To sit there, right now, the synagogue that is left in Yanina was one of two synagogues, two pre-World War II synagogues. The second one had to be destroyed because the Nazis had desecrated it, used it as a stable, and with the small community that was there of only 161 after the war, there was no need for two synagogues. On the walls of the synagogue now, in this synagogue that's one of these old, massive Ottoman-style synagogues with the high ceilings, the natural light coming in, that echoes with the emptiness because the whole community only numbers 32 now. On the walls of the synagogue are etched in stone the names of all 1,861 Jews that perished in the Holocaust. To sit there and fill that synagogue up with joy, to celebrate a simcha, to me is a mitzvah. And to sit there and have an aging survivor from the community hold my hand so tight and say, thank you for being here. How could I not be there? We help with the restoration of the cemetery there, we help with the restoration of the synagogue, and I think more than anything else, just by our being there, we let them know that all the way across on the other side of the Atlantic, there are people who still love them and still care about them. So that, it's never ended. It's never ended, Ken. Any more questions before I start crying?
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.